You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
In high tech or any role, Jennifer Byrne is an advocate for applying original thinking and personal conviction in order to create positive impact across work, personal, and public arenas. Utilizing wisdom gained from 20 years in the tech industry, Jennifer teaches others through her role as an advisor to startups, personal mentorship to young leaders, and a forthcoming book on how to apply an innovator's mindset in order to survive and thrive in today's fast-changing, tech-infused world. In her most recent role as a Chief Technology Officer of Microsoft US, Jennifer worked with companies and organizations across all industries and market segments to reframe their business opportunities in digital terms. Jennifer infused innovation practices into Microsoft technical field teams, which led to high-value and well-publicized digital transformation strategies with top global companies. Under Jennifer's leadership, her teams at Microsoft undertook innovation projects designed to foster inclusive growth in a cross-sector and community-oriented manner. She led the 15 Microsoft Technology Centers across the U.S., hosting thousands of customers and community events each year. Welcome to the Ivy Podcast, Jennifer.
Jennifer, thank you for finding time and joining us on the Ivy Podcast this afternoon. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, about your background, and what are you currently working on?
Well, sure. And first of all, thanks so much for inviting me. It's always such a privilege to have an audience to talk to, especially in times like this when we're all sort of stuck in our home offices. I have a history in technology. My most recent stint in corporate America was as the CTO for Microsoft's US division. I was at Microsoft for about 6 years in a variety of CTO and chief security officer positions. Fabulous opportunity for me to learn a lot about leadership and tech industry and what the world is up to with respect to using technology to create disruptive opportunities. Before that, 15 years or so in cybersecurity, and I started my career in the nonprofit world. I've left corporate America, I left Microsoft at the end of March, and I am writing a book that I'm just over the halfway point on. And super excited about that. We can talk about it later if you're interested. And I spend the balance of my time working with startups in a variety of advisory and board member roles where I get to focus on companies that I believe have really great potential for social impact, either because they are expressly in the business of creating social impact or because they're bringing some disruptive technologies to market that I believe is gonna have or can have truly positive effects on broader societal issues. So super busy still, and been a long journey in tech, always been interesting.
Oh, how exciting. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about that transition going from kind of that corporate world and now going to your almost your own business, so to say, because I've done that transition myself as well. I've been in corporate for quite some time with Citrix, Ultimate Software, big companies like yourself, very, technology oriented roles. And now I am, I'm in a much smaller organization and the Ivy Podcast, and I'm also currently working on a book as well. So I'm just curious, kind of how has that transition been so far for you?
Oh my gosh, that is a whole podcast in and of itself. It is, it's been fantastic. If you come from the perspective that the opportunities in life that challenge you the most are the best ones, I would say this has been a phenomenal opportunity for me. I don't think you can know how that transition is going to affect you until you're in the middle of it, because you just aren't aware of, you can't know how much you rely upon some of the structure of a corporate environment until you don't have it anymore. And a lot of people feel excited to be free of it. And, but there, I think are all moments when you realize that, it allows you as an individual to not develop certain competencies because you've got that. And case in point, it's really, really nice when you're in an office environment and you've got a lot of people giving you feedback, whether or not it's great feedback or truthful feedback, you get it all the time. And when you're on your own, you have to find that, you know, in yourself. So that's been a really interesting opportunity to figure out, you know, how much of my ego is involved in my job, and what do I really think about my abilities, and how good am I actually? So that's been interesting. The other thing that's interesting is that, you know, you get to, when you work for a company like Microsoft, you can kind of get into any door, right? In through any door, because you represent such a phenomenal company that is at the forefront of so many good things in the digitization of the world around us. But when you take that away, you really have just your own abilities to rely upon. And it's just a moment, it's a moment of humility, but it's also a moment to really reflect on, you know, what your value really is. It's scary and wonderful. And I've been in that process, and I would never, it's been a great experience, and I'm glad I have it. I don't see myself going back to corporate America. I think the next chapter of my life is actually going to play out better, as my own person, as a writer and evangelist and an advisor. But boy, did I learn a lot, over those years.
Oh, how exciting. And, you know, one thing that you've mentioned really stands out is that self-discipline. I think you've nailed it on the head. When you're part of a larger corporation, you have different avenues to get feedback. You have different ways, you know, motivation comes into play as well. But when you team of one, team of yourself, it's, you know, completely different ballgame. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about your book that you're working on. But before that, kind of to take a step back a little bit during your corporate, you know, experience when you were part of a larger organization like Microsoft. If you were kind of to put yourself in the shoes of, especially during current times with COVID, a lot of unprecedented times, what has worked well for you in terms of when it comes to either employee motivation or self-motivation? Because right now there's, you know, if we talk about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, everything is, you know, at the lowest level. It's, you know, safety and a lot of the basic things are a priority, and to think about innovation or motivation, those things not necessarily at the forefront. So I'm just curious to get your input on that.
Yeah, well, look, I think that the silver lining of really challenging times is you have an opportunity to learn a lot, because learning, you know, is learning how you're going to cope with an environment, learning how others are going to cope in an unexpected environment is itself, you know, sort of delivers rewards to you, because you come away with a deeper understanding of your team and its capabilities and how to manage people under stress. There's just a lot that I think is goodness that will come out, you know, out of this scenario, you know, when we start to realize the return of that, who knows, the returns on that investment, who knows. But I would say, you know, one thing that's surprising that I hear both from my peers who are still in big corporate jobs, but also echoed very loudly across the founder CEO community in the startup world, is that leaders don't always know how their employees are going to react to unexpected events, to downturns, to challenge, to this specific challenge of having to work remotely. And I think they are often surprised by who actually displays a lot of resilience and patience and fortitude through this process, even though maybe they're at home now working and they've got three little kids in the background and dogs and parents and whatever else, and other people who surprisingly don't. So I think, you know, it's a reminder as a leader that you have to be wildly curious about the people who work for you, and curious plus compassionate for those people, because it's only from that place that you're really gonna make sure that you're always listening very carefully to the experiences of those around you, because some people are gonna show up and not be able to, you know, do the job well because they're not managing these times as well as they would like to. And you've gotta be able to see that and hear that. I also think that, the other unique challenge that's come forth is this, you know, the transition to virtual work, although there are in Zoom calls or Teams calls or whatever, you know, your platform is, has a lot of built an efficiency into it, right? We're not commuting, meetings are easier. There's a lot that the virtual world makes possible that you don't have when you're wandering hallways in different buildings trying to find the conference room. That's not, so there's some efficiency, but you lose the serendipity of all of the chance encounters that you get when you walk in 3 minutes early into a meeting and you sit down next to somebody who you don't know, or, you know, you bump into somebody in the hallway, or you're forced to have a conversation with somebody who you would normally avoid because they happen to be sitting across the table from you. There's this thing that happens in synergy that happens in business that is directly a function of being physically in the same location that you can avoid when you're working in a virtual environment. And I think that itself is going to spawn a lot of innovation. I'm starting to see it in people rethinking, how do you do a virtual conference? How do you create that milieu of people in a virtual space? I think we'll see some fun stuff come out of that. But in the meantime, it's the same lesson for managers who really have to pay attention to their employees because they don't know who's going to cope well and who isn't. But they also have to pay attention to all of the sort of the side chatter, the conversations that are happening, and hoping that they do happen. If you can do that formally through some kind of workplace analytics tool, that's wonderful. If you have to do it informally because you're asking those questions, but just getting kind of your finger on the pulse of your team and how much natural communication is still happening, because that's where a lot of stuff gets done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Some, you know, very important points that you make. Especially, you know, I interview a lot of executives, whether that's, you know, Fortune 500 or, you know, founders of the, you know, smaller startups. And when we talk about this particular subject, as far as leading through, you know, through crisis, so to say, one theme that really does stand out, which kind of, were you talking about in terms of that really unscripted communication, so to say, that really empathy and really being able to not only relay the right message, but also listen. So that's, you know, that's very exciting to hear kind of from your perspective as well. To shift gears a little bit, can you, so tell us a little bit more about the book that you're working on, and what's the motivation behind it?
Okay. So the book is the inspiration behind the book. I'll tell you that part first, and then we can move into what it's about. Mm-hmm. The last few years that I was at Microsoft, I had this incredible opportunity to think about business development in social impact terms. And what I mean by that is that, you know, as a cloud company, well-known cloud company, you start to have to think about not just that you're trying to win more customers, but you really actually have to make sure that the world knows how to use technology, because that's really the market expansion opportunity for a company like Microsoft or AWS or Google or any other technology that's already pretty ubiquitous. If you're going to continue to grow from there, your outer edge is probably not people who are choosing your competitor so much as it is just people who are not themselves digitally empowered, you know, because they're running a small business and it's not digitized, or they're a consumer and they don't know how to, you know, sort of, you know, be digital in their daily lives or whatever it is, or they're, you know, employees in a company and the company can't move forward with a digital transformation project because they don't have employees who understand technology. That's kind of, so this digital, broad digital empowerment initiative or impetus within Microsoft was as much about doing good for the world as it was about just making sure that there is a market ready to receive technology. So I had this privilege of working in communities to think about how do you make sure everybody is digitally empowered. And ultimately that conversation leads to communities that aren't, and those communities that aren't are typically underserved or disadvantaged in some way. And it was such a privilege because, and I would say this a lot, that it was a really interesting alignment of the stars where you could have this very positive social impact initiative that also aligned with the business interests of a for-profit company. And very rarely do those nonprofit plus for-profit missions align so well as they did. And so I spent a lot of time doing that. But one of the things I quickly came to realize is that although all the data, whether it be from World Economic Forum or any of the big policy think tanks, or even kind of the ground up knowledge from chief learning officers and HR officers in big companies, is that jobs, we're kind of at this inflection point where technology is going to start eliminating more jobs than it creates, and it's going to start disrupting traditional roles in a way that our economy is probably not ready for. And all of that's kind of gotten overshadowed by the pandemic and all these things that are happening this year, but the problem remains. And so the worry is, oh my gosh, you know, all of these years I've been spending talking to customers and trying to convince them art of the possible around what technology can do for them. Happy consequence of that is that we'll have a lot of people who don't have the skills that they need, don't have jobs, and don't know where to go next. So that's the problem statement of, oh my gosh, I think, you know, I've been so lucky to have this great career in tech. I've done very well for myself. I've had a ton of amazing experiences that I wouldn't have had in any, you know, would never have had a hope of having in any other way. But is it time now to actually do some good in the world? Because I feel like I've also been a part of the world that said use technology, but not part of the world to date that said, okay, and let's make sure everyone has access to it. So the book is about how do you take all of the great innovation methodologies that have made us so successful in the tech world and apply them to your personal life. So it's a bit of a story of, you know, innovating, using innovation methodology for career development. Also a bit of my own story. I have sort of an unlikely path myself, and yeah, so that's the book.
Wow. That sounds, you know, very exciting. And you mentioned in terms of some of the innovation methodology, so to say, to the extent that you can share with us, I guess some of the strategies that you've deployed before, or you define, you know, in this book, when it comes to innovation, what recommendations or, you know, practical advice can you provide when it comes to, you know, that creative problem solving or coming up with innovative ways to solve certain problems?
Yeah, well, I think it's roughly it's half mindset, half methodology. So on the mindset side of the equation, if you look at the, you know, the ways that the greatest innovators of our time have solved problems or created solutions, very little of it's actually a net new technology invention. Not that there aren't all sorts of those as well, but a lot of the innovations that have made a big difference in the world are really just thinking about the same old problem in a new way. So Elon Musk talks about this a lot. He refers to it as reasoning and first principles, which is to say, throw out all of your assumptions about what you think should work, or, you know, assumptions about why you think certain things work the way they do, and reason from the ground up. Another way of saying that is kind of a root cause analysis where you continue to ask yourself, why until you get to your first set of assumptions about a problem, because only from there can you have a fresh look, or can you, you know, sort of establish a fresh view of an old problem. So it's the canonical Uber or Airbnb stories where Uber didn't invent anything, right? All they did was look at the transportation problem in a very new way, Airbnb the same. And so many of those innovations that we've seen in the last 20 years have just done that. So it's a mindset to acknowledge that there's more you don't know than you do. It's a mindset around curiosity and courage and risk. And then methodology, look, there's a ton of methodology out there, design thinking methodology, you know, human-centered design, lots of processes that we can borrow from that are frankly widely used across the tech industry and other industries that are, you know, are high on the innovation scale. And there's no reason why you can't just take that and apply it to yourself.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. As you're writing your book, and I can relate on many levels, want to hear more a little bit personal productivity hacks, and how do you not only kind of stay focused and, you know, allocate specific time to not only writing and other projects that you have going on from your standpoint, and especially in these times on a lot of lockdowns and these, you know, fully remote workforce, what strategies or tools and techniques that help you personally stay productive during these times?
Well, that's a great question. If you can have an awesome work environment, that helps. I do. Although I just moved into a new house that I built, and for a couple of months before that, I was living in sort of transitional housing and trying to also be productive. And so I'm also very familiar with the fact that you can't always have a great work environment. Sometimes you just have to do the best you can at your kitchen table. I think the for me, probably the single most important thing is to find whatever is the best measure of your personal productivity. And that differs from person to person. Most people measure in terms of time, right? Because that's been the default measurement of productivity, you know, for the last 150 years, right? As we've become industrialized, time was the metric. And I don't think you can use time when you're working on your own and when you're working from home. I think you have to, for me anyway, the measure is my to-do list. You know, I just know I have certain things I've got to get done, whether I set them as an aspirational goal for myself or I have an actual deadline that has to get done. You know, the old saying that what gets measured gets done. So if I can get it done in 4 hours, great. And if I can get done, if I have to stay sort of chained to my desk until I'm done, then that's what I do. So those are the hacks. But, you know, there's an equal or there's a sort of this mitigating thing to that self-imposed discipline and making yourself work is, you know, can feel kind of negative. And so I think it's also really important to take advantage of all the positive things that come with working remotely. And if that's, you know, your ability to play really loud music while you're working, because nobody, you know, you're not going to bother anybody, or you can, you know, take walks or naps at times of the day that are normally taboo, or, you know, whatever it is, a kind of creative multitasking of unloading your dishwasher while you're, you know, on a call, you're just listening. Like, do all those things as much as possible, because they give you the positive reinforcement of working from home. And typically, and, you know, in high achieving people, we only think very critically, like, I've got to do this, I got to do this differently, but reward yourself as well.
Right. Love those recommendations. Thank you for sharing that. I want to talk a little bit about women in leadership or female executives, especially in tech. Those topics are very important, especially, you know, on the Ivy podcast. We actually have a whole category dedicated to that, and a lot of the questions and comments we get from our listeners are, you know, evolved around these topics. And good portion of our listeners are, you know, either second year MBAs or the recent graduates from, you know, different schools. What can you share with, you know, with in a very high level, I guess, a summarized view with, you know, our female listeners when it comes to career growth, work-life balance, or anything that you wish you did during your early stage career?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking that question. It's such an important conversation. I have two big pieces of advice or categories of advice, if you will. And one of them is something that was taught to me by a mentor of mine, I don't know how long ago, a while ago. And it's this notion of understanding your value both as a function of what you have proven you can do, as well as a function of what you have the potential to do. And there are some studies, and I don't know, you know, how old they are, how relevant they are. So, you know, the usual disclaimer about, you know, the comment, there are studies. There's some studies that demonstrate that men are far more likely to, maybe I shouldn't use far more, are more likely to be measured both by themselves and by others with respect as a function of their, what they have the potential to do. And women tend to get measured both by others and measure themselves based on what they have proven they can do. And clearly proven is a lagging indicator, potential is a leading indicator, right? And so if you get yourself stuck in a conundrum, if you're only ever, you could, it's very small increments that you'll make in the advancement of your career if you're only ever relying on what you've proven you can do, because then you can only offer up, well, I can do this, maybe a tiny bit more, or its potential is unbounded. So I think that's a good mindset for people who are young in career to have, because it shows up. Every interview you have, every networking opportunity you have with somebody who could be a future manager or mentor of yours is, you know, are opportunities for you to express yourself, either in terms of your what you've proven you can do, which is pretty tough in your early stages of your career, and there's not a lot you've been able to prove you can do, or what you have the potential to do. And I think, you know, very related to that is that when you start thinking about it very, very broadly. So we know in careers that there is this broad shift toward valuing a diversified skill set more than a diversified skill set used to be valued when, you know, sort of when more traditional careers were more the norm. And the reason why that's important is because if you are thinking about your career over the next 10 to 15 years, and you know you need a diversity of skills and experience, then a much better way to get there is to think about your potential very broadly. You know, so you don't just have a specific technical certification, you have an ability to think in systems, right? You don't just have writing, you know, you're not just good at writing technical briefs, you're actually a great writer and communicator. So thinking about yourself more broadly is important. We oftentimes, I think everybody does this early in career, value our skills and capabilities based on the feedback that we've received from our managers or our peers. And so if your manager told you were good at something, then that must be what you're good at. And that's a tough one. So you actually have to be very careful to always receive feedback and sort through it, but don't lose your inner voice as well. The one that you know, was in the room when no one else was in the room and you were kicking ass on a project. And just because nobody knew about it or not everyone agree with you doesn't mean you don't know that you actually have a talent somewhere. So making sure that you're balancing, you know, the feedback around you with the feedback within you. And then with respect to sort of work-life balance, look, that's a tough problem. I think it's, again, one of the smaller silver linings of COVID-19 and all of us working from home is that we have this unavoidable level of transparency into each other's lives, because just you can't help but know that there are kids in the background when people are working, and you see them, you know, they don't get dressed, and everyone is a little bit more transparent. And I hope that that means that when everybody goes back into more traditional offices, if they do, that they carry that memory with them, that actually we all have all sorts of different circumstances we're dealing with in our personal lives. And yes, women traditionally have the issue of, you know, being primary caregivers to children and trying to balance that, you know, traditional female work-life balance issue. Turns out everybody's got an opportunity to be empathetic to that, because turns out we all have those kinds of issues.
Right. Those are great recommendations. And I know we should probably do a completely separate episode just on that topic, but thank you for doing such a great job summarizing, you know, some of that valuable advice. Really appreciate it. Jennifer, last but not least, while you're writing your own book, what are you currently reading, and what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why?
I'm reading two books right now. One of them is called Good Economics for Hard Times, and the other one is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And there, I mean, look, if you caught me in another day, I would have told you I was reading a Dean Koontz book. So I don't think I always read hard stuff, but they're books on economics, and I am reading them because I am so flummoxed by what is going on in the world around us. I feel like there are underlying sort of structures and systems, or attributes of systems and structures, that I'm missing, and that we're all missing, that if I had them, I would better understand where the world is going. And, you know, economics is a social science, and it's a social system. And so I'm trying really hard right now to figure out what the economic underpinnings are of the current scenario. So read those two books. They're killing me, by the way. They're super hard to read, learning a ton. I'm going to have to go read some Dean Koontz books after that, just to, you know, kind of recover. The books, I always recommend three. So I'll say the super fast. The two books that I've given out to people consistently over the last, I would say almost 3 years now, one of them is Weapons of Math Destruction, Math, M-A-T-H, by Kathy O'Neill. And it's still a very, very good book for understanding the unintended consequences of big data, AI, machine learning, and some of the statistical vulnerabilities that lead to increase in equity. I think that's just a phenomenally important book for everyone to read. The second book is called Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. It's actually super fun and easy to read, but you can't, we're gonna enter the world of quantum computing. We're already there, but it's gonna be mainstream, you know, in sort of the proverbial blink of an eye. Having a little bit of a refresher course on physics itself is, I think, extremely important if, you know, things like quantum computing, quantum physics, quantum chemistry, all that, you know, these things become more mainstream. Let's make sure we have at least a primer on that. And then the third book is called Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And that was the first book I read right before my first management job in technology. And it aligns very much to my view that if you want to be a good leader, you have to know yourself. And so it was a book that helped me do that.
Wow, that's great. I was personally taking notes, and for our listeners, will make the titles and authors of these books available in the episode notes. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time today. I know we've covered a lot of different topics. I personally learned quite a bit. Really appreciate your wisdom and your insights. Definitely keep us in touch. I want to know when the book goes live so we can probably do another episode, talk about that. And definitely thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Pleasure is mine. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.